First, have you ever found yourself stuck in traffic and thinking to yourself, there's got to be a better way? Cars are supposed to offer us independence, and roads are supposed to make it easier for us to get around. But our guest this afternoon lives in Chicago, where drivers spend roughly 4 days a year stuck in traffic jams while our freeways have divided and, in some cases, decimated communities. Our guest's new book asks us to re-examine our relationship with our automobiles and consider shifting our transportation priorities toward those that do the least amount of damage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like your car is worth the cost? Do you wish there were other, maybe better transportation alternatives to the automobile in your community? Have you ever been to a place or lived in a place where it was easy to get around and do all the stuff you want to do without a car? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Knowles is the Midwest correspondent for The Economist and author of the new book, Carmageddon: How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you ever so much for having me on. I'm delighted.
I want to make a distinction right up front here, Daniel. The theme of your book is not people who drive cars are bad, but we've made decisions over the past century plus that make it so you, in many cases, don't have a choice but to take a car. Can you spell out that distinction in what you're shooting for here?
Exactly. It's kind of a collective action problem. I think that basically, you know, if you're the only person who has a car, having a car is great. You know, they get you from A to B really, really quickly, really well. But the problem is that when everybody gets a car, everything spreads out in such a way that it kind of stops alternatives from working, and you kind of have to have a car. You know, the way that a lot of American cities, and actually some quite a few cities in Europe too and elsewhere in the world, are designed, it's very difficult to do without a car. And part of the problem is because there are so many cars. You know, cars use up so much land, they force cities to sprawl, and when everything has so much parking and road space, you kind of need a car because everybody else has a car. So it's not that you're individually at fault, it's that kind of you're being forced to get a car by how everything's set up.
I want to look at one key turning point you write about in American history, and other countries have faced a similar problem. Cars start to show up and people are very offended. You are infringing on my freedom to walk on a street. I have to watch out for this car that might run me over. People form organizations. They hold safety parades worried about cars. Then what happens to flip things around?
So, I mean, it's fascinating reading the history of that period, because exactly as you say, cars were not kind of initially accepted as this great, wonderful invention. You know, people were really upset. They killed a lot of people. They were dangerous and they took the road away. And you had these protests, you know, and particularly in America, what happened essentially was in part a kind of organized lobbying effort. And you had motor dealerships, car dealerships, and wealthier people and people, you know, who kind of had an interest in cars, began to lobby for things like jaywalking laws, for things like the building of expressways. You know, the idea being, oh, we'll separate the fast traffic from the people, which, you know, did reduce deaths, but meant that you kind of led to the spreading out of cities and the dependence on cars. And that created this environment where basically people sort of, as some people got cars, it became harder for the people without cars to get by. You know, as cars proliferated, streetcar networks, which is how most American cities kind of used to work up until about 1930s, they suddenly didn't work very well because they were always stuck in traffic. So sort of as some people got cars, it became that kind of very difficult for you to keep going without a car. So more people had to get a car. And of course, it was this aspirational thing, but over time, it just became sort of, you know, you're running to catch up. We kind of, your cars drive your distance, a further distance faster, but actually everywhere is just further apart than it used to be. So you're spending as much time traveling as you were before, you know, before we had any cars at all. And that's kind of what's happened sort of all over the world, actually.
Before we get into the harm side of things, one more trend you track is this idea. Okay, we got a lot of cars, so there's a lot of congestion. So obviously we make more lanes, whether that's adding lanes to current roads or adding newer, faster roads along the way, that will logically cure the congestion problem. What actually happens?
So I actually have a great example of this at the moment, which is kind of the opposite. It's the Kennedy Expressway in Chicago, which is near my house. Right now, there have been several lanes closed, a lot of the time over the last couple of weeks, as they're rebuilding it. And of course, a lot of the local media, a lot of people were very worried about all of the traffic and talked about it. And what's actually happened is that, people have anticipated that traffic is bad and they've changed the times that they travel, and more people are getting on the metro trains and people have adjusted. And actually, what's happened, there was some data I saw yesterday, is that sometimes at rush hour, traffic on the Kennedy has actually been better than it was with the lanes closed than it was when it was open. Now, obviously, people have had to adjust. There's not there are no costs to this, but what happens when you widen a freeway is the opposite. People kind of they think, oh well, it's wider, it will be faster, and for a little while it is, but over time everybody kind of adjusts how they act and they get slower because you just get more cars on the road, so people take journeys that they wouldn't have driven, or they go further than they would have otherwise done, and the traffic's as bad as it was before. And that can happen really quite quickly, and in cities, if you widen highways, the evidence is pretty clear that you don't really reduce the congestion at all. You actually increase it because people drive journeys that they probably wouldn't have driven before. So you get more cars on the road, that uses up the traffic space of the extra lanes, and then means more cars on all the kind of feeder roads too.
Talking to Daniel Knowles. His new book is called Carmageddon: How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns about the car culture we've built up here in the United States? Do you have fixes in mind? Are there things you'd like to see changed? Do you have questions for our guest about the work he did in this book? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Daniel, part of the subtitle of the book, How Cars Make Life Worse. Let's get into some of the things you see as harm. First of all, to neighborhoods and urban communities as we expand these roads, what do you see as the main consequences there?
Well, I think it just makes it neighborhoods that people drive, that everybody has to drive in. They're not, they don't, they can be quite isolating, particularly if you don't have a car. But it means that, you no longer are able to walk down the street to pick up a pint of milk. You may be less likely to know your neighbors. You are, and you have things like supermarkets. It's a real problem in lots of communities in, here in Chicago, but lots of communities in America, that you won't have somewhere that you can do grocery shopping nearby, because essentially these kind of huge supermarkets, that rely on everybody driving to them, kind of dominate the market. And so I think kind of they make life more fractious. There's also quite a lot of evidence that if you're reliant on your car for a commute, that it's the least sort of makes people unhappy in a direct way. Driving is actually quite stressful. You have to focus on the road ahead of you. It's unpredictable. You don't know whether you're going to arrive in 40 minutes or an hour, depending on the traffic, and that means that people are kind of stressed out about how bad the traffic might be. And I think it makes people, it's quite stressed out in a way that's also not a direct kind of economic cost, and but is something that you have to sort of count too. And adds, I think, to our general sense sometimes, particularly living here in America, but kind of, we're not perfect in Europe at all, that life is very exhausting and tiring, is how much time we're spending dealing, piloting these vehicles around all day.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Janet is with us in Madison. Janet, hi.
Hi. I had noticed that I wasn't driving a lot, and it seemed kind of crazy that all our cars sit around parked 95% of the time. So 2 years ago, I started a car share program, and we now have 13 people in the program. We're driving two cars, and we may be looking at getting a third. And one of the great things about this is it's very economical, but also when people are sharing a car, they actually stop and think about their driving, and they drive less and consider taking the bus or a bike or walking or combining trips more than when they invest so much into their private car.
Interesting, Janet. Thanks for sharing that. Daniel, what do you think?
Janet, I think that's absolutely brilliant. I'm a member of Zipcar because, you know, every now and again, even if you're somebody like me who goes everywhere on a bike, you do need a car. You know, you do need to go and pick up something heavy or whatever. And so I use Zipcar, and I wish there were more available, because I think what's really good about car sharing programs is that one of the problems with cars, how it works at the moment, is that, you know, cars are very expensive up front. You know, you've got to buy one. It might, you know, you've got to pay insurance. You've got to have somewhere to park it. But, you know, you're paying all of those kind of upfront costs to own a car. But then once you've sort of got it, you know, it does sit parked most of the time. And actually driving it kind of an extra mile is quite cheap. It's just the cost of the gasoline you're putting in it. And so people buy cars because, you know, they do have that one trip, or they have certain things that maybe they do really need a car for that. But then once they've got it, you think you might as well use it for every journey, because you've paid for it already. And car sharing, I think, can kind of change some of the dynamics of that a bit. It means that you don't have to pay the whole cost of a car. You split it with some people. You've still got one available for when you really need a car. But you look at the cost as the marginal cost, as the cost of that one journey when you're using it, rather than, you know, the $11,000 or whatever you're spending on, that's actually the total cost of owning a car on average in the US. But whatever your car payment is, you're not thinking, well, I've paid that anyway. You're thinking, oh, I could do this journey in a car for $10, or I guess I could get on my bike and save that this time. So it means that each time you're kind of considering, you know, the like real cost at a time. And when that happens, people use their cars less. And so I think, you know, car sharing, I have a lot of hope for.
Janet, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Daniel Knowles, Midwest correspondent for The Economist, author of the new book, Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. We're looking at how our commitment to cars, he says, has created lots of unintended consequences, what it might take to find more alternatives. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel stuck, like you have to have a car to do anything? Do you wish there were more alternatives? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Daniel Knowles, Midwest correspondent at The Economist and author of the book, Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. We're looking at how cars have helped to shape our communities for better or worse, and the decisions that could shape the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think are the best ways to cure traffic congestion? What would it take for you to live and work without a car? You think it's possible? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on another caller now. Mike is with us in New London. Mike, hi.
Hi, Daniel and Rob. I appreciate you getting me on the air. I actually was working on a little essay I enjoy writing, and I'm titling it Reflections on a Dead Woodcock, which is a little game bird in the state of Wisconsin and others. And we happened to see it this week walking the town, my wife and I, but that a car had obviously run it over, along with other roadkill that you see, you know, every day. But I think cars have impacted the divisiveness in our society in the following way. If you think of it, back in the horse and buggy days, which was only 100 years ago, people needed each other. You helped each other. You were considerate. Look at then, early autos weren't very trustworthy. And over the course of years, I'm 60 something now, there you hurtle along in this little enclosed unit. You don't, in a sense, need anybody. You're not close to anybody except maybe to give them the finger, you know, if you're upset. And the second, that's how they hurt divisiveness. You don't need anybody. Like
gotcha.
We used to.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Daniel, this idea of social isolation if the car is our main mode of transportation, Mike says.
I think that's absolutely right. It's actually almost a better answer to one of your earlier questions than the one I gave myself. you know, and I think kind of for if you look at the history of segregation in America, you know, racial segregation, and it goes hand in hand with the car. And I write about this in the book, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s, as kind of formal legal segregation began to be, you know, undermined finally, and black people were given civil rights. And over an awful lot of cities essentially began to use freeway construction, you know, as a way of getting, of essentially kind of reinforcing racial segregation. And if you look at, you know, I wrote about Atlanta a bit in the book, one of several places, but you know, if you're in your own car, your own individual car, you don't have to share space with somebody of another race. And I think in a lot of countries, actually, particularly countries with very high levels of inequality, you know, I used to live in India and I used to live in Kenya, and I wrote about them in the book too, you know, countries where, you know, the rich really are a kind of on a different level to the poor, even more so than in America. There's a real sort of horror of the idea that you might have to share space, share public transport with, you know, with much poorer people. And it leads to this very kind of car-centric development in those countries too. And so I think there is that, I think there's a lot to that kind of observation. It's a sort of way of, a car shelters you to some extent from the community, the society you're moving through while you're in it. So you don't have to engage with it as much. And perhaps then, you know, if you are on the kind of privileged side of that divide, you're protected a bit from it too. So
thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Daniel Knowles about his new book, Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. Daniel, I want to get to the what to do about it part a little bit now. And you point toward a number of communities, cities around the world that you see taking steps in the right direction. What do you see as the most inspirational?
So I wrote a whole chapter about Tokyo, and in fairness, this is perhaps not the most inspirational in the right way, because Tokyo sort of was never dominated by cars. They, after World War II, you know, it was kind of flattened, obviously, in the war, but the way it was rebuilt was in this way that it's, you can have a car in Tokyo, and lots of Japanese people do own cars, and, you know, in fact, there are a whole kind of, you know, car nuts, people who love their cars, but what you have is a world where it's very difficult to park your car. Parking is not free, you know, or street parking almost non-existent. You have to pay tolls to use the expressways, and the public transport's extremely good. And so people choose mostly not to use their cars unless, you know, that's something special or something where they really need it for. And I think that's a kind of the city that's doing best. But I also think inspirational, you know, I say talk about Paris and Copenhagen, but actually one place in this region which I think has been doing some remarkable stuff in recent years is Minneapolis, which has built some, you know, I was there last summer and I was there recently, and, you know, the public transport's not terrible, but they've built incredible bike lanes, and they're building, so, you know, they have so many new apartments and homes going up near the city center, near where the jobs are, so that, you know, if you live in one of those places, you won't have to commute, you know, 30, 40 miles to get to work in your car each day. You could probably get there on a bicycle if you want to. And so I think there's some quite inspirational stuff happening, you know, in various parts of America that we, you know, where we still think of as being very car-centric cities. So I think it is happening.
Time for one more caller. Laura is with us in Cudahy. Laura, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to agree with one of your previous callers talking about how a car can isolate one. I'm 64. I've been riding the bus my whole life. And one of the things that I love about taking the bus is that I'm not isolated from others. I am exposed to so many different kinds of people as I go through so many different neighborhoods. It makes me feel connected to others, and it also makes I feel like it helps me to be a better human being, because I just feel connected to people. And I had also wanted to say, Rob, I know that you sometimes talk about waiting for the bus, and I really appreciate that, because it kind of normalizes, you know, people taking public transportation. I think we need so much more of that in this country.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. And Daniel, it's easy for me to talk about taking the bus. I happen to have a house near half the bus lines in town and a workplace that's the same, that's not necessarily a viable option for a large percentage of the population. What would it take to have my experience riding the bus and Laura's more inviting and accessible?
I mean, you know, in America, I think just investing in buses would be a pretty good start. But, you know, a lot of American cities, you know, Canadian cities look quite similar to American cities in terms of the spread, the layout, the grids, the rest of it. And they have twice as much kind of bus service on average, as a study I read recently. So having more buses would be the good thing. I also think that sometimes there are certain kind of trade-offs that we have to make. And I, you know, sometimes American cities tend to see buses as public services for the very poor. And so they will make sure that there's a bus that, you know, for people who don't have cars at all and can't use them. And so they'll make sure that a bus can take you to every part of the city. And that's good. You know, you do want that. But one of the problems is that if you have a bus, you know, if your buses go everywhere, but they only go once every hour, they're not a very, you know, they're not really a practical alternative to driving for an awful lot of people. You need frequent buses. And you know, I'm a Londoner and I moved to Chicago and I use the buses here in Chicago. And actually, when you get on the bus in Chicago, it's great because it's a grid. They get there pretty quickly, but you end up waiting for them really quite often too long. And then they do get stuck in traffic, and so I think kind of doing things to speed up the buses too, so that they, you know, can move down their own lanes, that sort of thing. So that, you know, that way you can turn them into a really good alternative to driving, because, you know, you don't have to park the bus, you just get on it, you get off it. And, you know, apart from all the other benefits of, yeah, you get to share space, you get to see the neighborhoods, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to drive, you can look at your phone or you can read a book or whatever. So I think buses can actually be pretty great, but it takes work and it takes kind of treating them as a very serious alternative to driving. Mm-hmm.
And we'll leave it there. Daniel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Daniel Knowles. His new book is Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. Read a lot of that on the bus today. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.